Hey everybody, welcome to the A&N After Show. It's me, Lindsay Loveridge, and with me is James Beckett.
For a second, I was really confused as to why my name tag said Scrappy-Doo is my homie. And then I only just noticed
that that was there.
Scrappy-Doo is my homie.
So Scrappy-Doo is your homie. Yeah. Off camera a couple weeks ago, I think we were talking about, it was during Preview Guide, and we were talking about Terrified Teacher at Ghoul School.
Yeah.
And everyone was making the Scooby-Doo comparisons.
You can't make a show about a scaredy cat teaching at a ghoul school without at least drawing comparisons to Scooby-Doo in ghoul school.
Ghoul school. I probably watched that on Halloween as a kid multiple years in a row because they would always do it on like ABC or on Cartoon Network or something. Mm-hmm. But you shared something in there and I remember saying like, this is the first time I've realized, and I don't know why it took me so long, that you have Scrappy-Doo energy.
Oh yeah. I'll take that.
Yeah. Yeah, James is A&N's personal Scrappy-Doo, and I will stand by that. Okay. So, hey, everybody, welcome to the show. We have a lot of news, actually, to get through. One story that broke today, so we'll be talking about Toho's purchase of G-Kids. There's also been those Pokemon leaks that have been proliferating, so we're going to talk about those somewhat. What's been leaked, and also how some of those leaks may entirely be fake. And we don't have a way to verify right now what is real and what is just made up for funsies to see if anyone will fall for it.
Life in 2024 is so fun.
Right. So we have that. And then we're also going to, I'll talk about Uzumaki episode 3 a little bit, and we'll talk about Dandadan episode 2, which, you know, amazing. If you guys aren't watching that, it's on Thursdays, Crunchyroll and Netflix. So you have your option of where to stream. And we're going to talk about Orb because there was quite a plot twist at episode 3 for people who are not manga readers that may have come out of nowhere. So once again, reminding everyone to please subscribe to this channel, YouTube. We're also on Facebook and we're streaming live on X as well. So you can send us little hearts through that and we'll see it. You can also just set alerts so that, you know, I don't know if I'd actually recommend that. You set alerts for the official Anime News Network Twitter channel. You will probably get an alert at least once an hour.
Yeah.
Because we publish a lot every single day. But, you know, you could do that if you really, really want to stay on top of it. Oh, also, shout out to Coop, who is in the chat. He says, if James is Scrappy-Doo, I can't help but fathom what role he plays in the James Gunn written movie that comes out like 20 years after the original show.
Obviously, I try to murder all of my former colleagues in a fit of vengeful rage. So I'm not saying that any of you guys need to be worried, but if you ever get invited to a spooky island theme park by an enigmatic multi-billionaire, I would say, you know, just watch out.
Just watch out, because it's either you or it's Elon Musk. So both are bad situations, right?
I know. Oh, man. But Elon Musk's theme park would just suck. Yeah. I would at least put in the effort.
Yeah, that's true. I care
enough about theme park experiences that I would make sure that it was up to snuff.
Up to snuff before we meet our wacky end.
Yeah. Or you just unmask me and, you know, I'm humiliated and I have to rally against you meddling adult professionals.
You meddling adult professionals and your stupid dog too. Yeah. Okay. Let's dive right into news. We'll dive into Toho and G-Kids. So for those of you who haven't heard of this, news broke only within last several hours or so. Japanese conglomerate Toho has acquired North American anime distributor G-Kids as a subsidiary, as a 100%. Acquisition. We don't know how much they bought it for. Hopefully good money. This is part of Toho's larger expansion into outside the Japanese market. For those who aren't familiar with Toho, Godzilla.
Yeah.
They own all of the Godzilla, but they're also like a huge film distributor in Japan. Oh, yeah. So that includes anime, like the My Hero Academia movie. It's Toho. Especially the latest one, actually.
If you watch any amount of like Japanese cinema, I guarantee you, you've seen their logo pop up at some point or another.
They're involved in all kinds of movie television distribution. One of the things that has me concerned about this, it's kind of twofold for G-Kids being acquired specifically. G-Kids is amazing. They've released a ton of great stuff over here. so far. I mean, Lookback was them as well.
Lee's main distributors.
Yeah. And, but they don't, they also don't just do anime. Like, they do a lot of international animation. They did Secret of the Kells.
Yeah. They did all the Cartoon Saloon.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they've done all of Cartoon Saloon. They've also done some stuff out of France as well.
Ernest and Celestine?
Yeah, that was. So G-Kids' catalog is beyond just anime. And I don't know how this Toho acquisition will affect that. I mean, on the other hand, like, Toho also isn't just animation. Like, this could also be live action, like Japanese live action films and things like that as well. The other part of it is just that Anime News Network included, Japanese conglomerates buying everything up and not leaving a lot of independent labels. So I was talking about this with friends, but after this purchase, the only anime distribution within the United States that's still independent is Discotech, Anime Diego, and Media Blasters.
Yeah.
What's left of Media Blasters. So that's it. Everything else is like owned by Sony. Or owned by another major company.
Everything else is owned by a big conglomerate.
I don't know. It doesn't make me super comfy, I guess. I don't know that that's necessarily healthy. Oh, I was going to say Sentai Filmworks isn't owned by a Japanese conglomerate, but it is owned by AMC.
I was going to say, AMC bought them. And
yeah.
What have they done with them? Have they done anything really with that?
I mean, I don't know if that's good or bad. It might mean that they're just letting them do whatever they want.
That's true. I guess that's true. I guess I don't know. I guess they did do the nice app and the website refresh after.
Yeah.
I think that was after the acquisition. So
I think so. Yeah.
They got a little bit of money to spruce up their UX and
they're still being reserved in their streaming licensing. Like, especially this season, they've got Danmachi season 5, which they've had Danmachi this entire time. All Guys Mixer.
I know I went there once during preview.
Yeah.
I think that was it.
Yeah. I can't recall what else they have this season. And then Amazon's picked up a few and Netflix has picked up a few.
I know. Amazon come crawling back to the anime.
Come crawling back to get like the one.
Screwed it up with Anime Strike. I just remember there was, what was it? How long ago was it? There was one season, maybe two seasons in like a row, where High Dive had, I mean, they weren't, you know, they weren't like neck and neck with Crunchyroll, but they had like a solid, probably like 10, you know, like pretty high profile shows. There were a couple of seasons there where I was on High Dive pretty regularly, either for shows I was covering or just for shows that were going. And it seems like
when they had Akiba Maid War.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it seems like in the past, maybe like year or so, I feel like that's really slowed down again. Like, thanks, Amazon, again.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a new Urusei Yatsura as well. And they have Oshinoko.
That's their big, I mean, that's their big get as of recently.
Yeah. Yeah. Folks are saying their app became unwatchable. So I'm curious what platform that is. I've always, you know, had, and they had Eminence of Shadow too, which is another good one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious what platform, because I remember people having issues with like the Funimation app back when that was relevant, and I never really had issues with the Funimation app.
Yeah, I know it can be really unreliable for me on my Roku.
Okay.
That one's always really kind of sketchy. On mobile, it's fine.
I've never had real issues with it on browser. I use Xbox app and I do use Roku, and I do think it's like pretty laggy, unresponsive on Roku, so it's like just hard to get to where you want.
And the subtitles are like, it's just like the closed captioning on Roku. That's just a Roku thing that annoys me. I always have to fiddle with that, but
yeah. Anyways, do you have any like feelings about this acquisition, James? GK?
I mean, like you said, it's similar to High Dive. It's possible that Toho will just leave them alone. If anything, the Godzilla fan in me was wondering if maybe this means we can get some like decent stateside releases of the Japanese films, because Shin Godzilla and Godzilla Minus One got kind of a bare bones treatment. Shin Godzilla got that Funimation disc, which was not great. They lost a lot of the nuance with the subtitle like encoding and stuff that like the theatrical prints had. And then the Shin Godzilla DVD. They did that funny thing where they said, to preserve the experience, we're giving you all of these Japanese bonus features with no subtitles.
Thanks,
guys. That's awesome. Yeah.
Some of the Godzilla films have been released by Criterion Collection, though, haven't they?
The original Godzilla was. Yeah. And then they got the Showa era. So, like, everything up through Terror of Mechagodzilla. There was, like, this weird... I can't remember who did. It had, like, the green covers, and they were all double feature Blu-rays of the Heisei era stuff. And, like, some of those are really hard to find now. Godzilla 84 still is, like, nowhere to be found. I even had to... I actually ordered from Etsy a custom-made box set with DVD slipcases for the Showa era. And just to have... because it looks so terrible on my DVD shelf, just like the random sizes and colors and stuff. And if we could get like a franchise collection of Godzilla,
like the aesthetic I need for my shelf aesthetic, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much history there that is just kind of being, you know, lost to the Western audiences. So that's one area where it could be nice for this one niche interest of mine. But I'm generally not super crazy about all the corporate takeovers. I don't think it's great. That's how you get things like where Google's at now, where every product of Google's is like five times worse than it was 10 years ago.
Like, I hope they retain all the staff. Like, obviously, like,
yes,
we retained all of our staff when this happened. But I'd like to see that as well. Like, everyone I've worked with at GKids is great.
They're so passionate, and like, they're working so hard to make things accessible for people.
Yeah.
We've talked about it so many times. We're living in this era where we can look back on a movie theater, as long as we get the location of the theater correct and remember the damn showtime, but we can do that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, again, 10 years ago, that would have been a pipe dream. Like, oh yeah, I hope I someday get to see it on a really expensive $80 Blu-ray that comes out in like limited release, you know, 5 years after the movie comes out.
Yeah. Coop makes a good point. It would be silly to throw out a team that won them an Oscar. So
it would be, but you know what? I'm just going to say that Toho sometimes makes decisions that are confusing. And I'll leave it at that.
Sure. Speaking of confusing, should we talk about some of these alleged lore drops that have come out of this Pokemon leak? Everything we're about to share is alleged. And that's because, one, this is due to a data breach. Mm-hmm. And so someone or some entity gained access to Game Freak's servers and just took what was supposed to be gigabytes of data.
So much stuff.
Like, so much stuff, including, I don't want like this to get lost, including former and current employee private information. We don't know if that information has specifically been released, but it was accessed. And so now Game Freak has to contact former contractors, former employees, current employees, and let them know about this. Yeah. That's the only thing Game Freak has really touched on out of these leaks, that it has affected their employees. Meanwhile, the internet has been having a heyday with what is supposed to be the results of this. Now, the reason I'm putting like alleged and like a big question mark on there is because we can't independently verify it.
No.
And as far as I know, no one has seen the actual Japanese documents. Everything that's been released was already translated, which means you can slip in fake stuff. And that has already been shown to include alleged Pokemon designs that weren't used that people found on DeviantArt. So people are definitely doing some troll stuff in here as well. So that puts a big over all of this, right?
Yeah.
So that being said, if this lore stuff is real, it's wild.
It's hilarious.
It's hilarious.
I hope it's real.
You hope it's real.
Just because I need to know that the fine folks at Game Freak think this hard about all of the weird ass shit that the Pokemon universe would have to include in order to be real. But like, no one would ever want to talk about it because these are games made for children.
Right. A lot of us who have been with this franchise for years and years and years have thought stupid things about some of the implications of the world that this exists in, right?
Ash's mom has been cohabitating with that Mr. Mime for decades. And I'm just saying.
There you go. That's one. And they hinted at some of this stuff even in the early games when they were like, Team Rocket are cutting off Slowpoke tails and selling them on the black market. And you're like, okay, so some people mutilate Pokemon.
Eat them.
and eat them in this world. That's always been a thing. Like, do people eat Pokemon? You know, do you eat Magikarp the same way you would regular fish? You know, those sorts of things. And it's not really elaborated on. You're just thinking about it. In the lore dumps, there's been at least what I assume are multiple instances of what we're going to call Pokemon-human relations.
Yeah.
Discussed, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff probably ended up on the cutting room floor for a reason.
Even stuff that was just made as like a brainstorming. Companies do that all the time, where they'll have their creative types like just do like little brainstorming sessions or free write things just to you know, keep the creative juices flowing, come up with some ideas that might end up, you know, working their way into like a little dialogue thing or a little cartoon or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that I read, which is about a man who definitely had multiple instances with an octillery, which for those who aren't familiar, it's just an octopus monster. As I read that, a lot of it reminded me of like classic mythology.
Yes. Yes.
Listen, the Zeus has fucked a lot of stuff, okay?
Well, the fisherman's wife.
Yes.
This is not like a new thing, right?
Mm-mm.
Never mind the fact that, I mean, one of the things we've joked about is like Pokemon can like understand you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's always been ambiguous, but I mean, some of them, what is it? My wife would kill me if she knew I forgot this one. The little shapeshifter fox. Zoroark.
Zoroark, okay.
Like, you know, there are Pokemon like that they can shapeshift and like
talk
and look like people. Meowth, you know, is from Brooklyn. And the minute you do that, people are naturally going to think, what kind of weird shit has happened between the smart Pokemon and the people, though?
Yeah.
And especially because, like, in myth, that's a thing. Shape-shifting creatures and
you know,
people that get spirited away and fall in love with, like, a ghost or a monster. Or whatever,
like, even what you just said about Zoroark, that's, like, classic to the Kitsune myth, where the mythical foxes are human shapeshifters, right? Nanigashi says when guys are jealous that only women have traditionally been the subject of tentacle porn. Yeah, I mean, hey, you know, something for everybody, right? Yeah. So in this whole one, it talks about a man who impregnates an octillery and then it gives birth to a boy. And this feels like at least two myths that I felt like I had heard before, but couldn't place where. Because then it turns into him like just going around injuring Ursa rings and then sleeping in a cave and waking up and seeing them as people, but they have all the injuries that he left on them. And I was like, why does that feel familiar? I feel like I need to talk to Rebecca Silverman because I feel like
she would know all of these.
She would know all of these. So I actually should just talk to her about it. But I was reading that and I was like, God, I've read this somewhere before. As wild as all of it is, it also felt grounded in something that I'd heard before. So it almost
I think something that's important to remember is that in Japan, more so than here, the Pokemon are much more connected to the concept of yokai than just beasties, you know?
Yeah.
That's why we have like, you know, Trubbishes and the ice cream ones, right? Like
the
idea, it's not just that they're animals, like they're meant to represent like folkloric entities as much
because some yokai are just objects, haven't been destroyed over so many years and then they become sentient.
You know, people are like, you know, making jokes about how obvious it must be, the proclivities of these Game Freak artists, which I mean, either way doesn't matter to me. But to be honest, the things that we've seen crop up on the internet, one of the things that makes me inclined to believe that they could very well be real is that they genuinely just feel like someone was like, oh, what would the myths of Pokemon world, specifically the Japanese flavored myths, what would they be?
Yeah.
Instead of like, guy falls in love with the Kitsune or the Crane Wife or Princess Kaguya. Like, what would the Pokemon equivalent of that be? And obviously it would involve Pokemon because that's the whole point.
All of their
spirits and gods and monsters and everything are just Pokemon. So
that's
kind of like the fun, right?
Yeah.
Instead of a werewolf, you'd have like a Arcanine or something.
Yeah. It's just, it all just like copies over in that way. I haven't looked really deep into everything. I saw that Typhlosion was trending on Twitter recently. I don't know why. Chat, can you tell me why if you want to. Maybe it's better that I don't know. I guess also to like tag on to it, one of the documents that came out was that allegedly they had considered wrapping up the Ash Pikachu arc for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons cited was due to the actresses, Rika Matsumoto, who plays Ash / Satoshi, and Ikue Otani, who is Pikachu, having strained relations. Now, people took that and they're like, oh, these actresses hate each other. Which, first of all, the strained relations could have just been with a producer or something. We don't know, even if, like...
They're not recording in the booth together, guys. That's not how...
Well, they could be, actually. In Japan, they often do...
I guess.
Record in the booth together.
For the Pika Pika noises, that would be... You'd be spending so much money paying her to be in the booth to make Pika Pika noises. Like, that... I mean, I am
curious if they've just got a data bank of her Pika Pika noises at this point, and they just have to continue. That's what I would do.
They've done 1,500 freaking episodes. Like, just pay her royalties, let her live her life.
Yeah.
And, like, that, I mean.
Pika Pika, yeah. Anyway, but people did take that ball and run with it, and were like, oh, Rika Matsumoto and Ikue Otani don't like each other, and all this sort of stuff, to the point where Matsumoto had to come out and be like, no. We get along fine. We even did an event together. And also, you guys are making this up and it doesn't make anyone happy. This is not a direct quote, but it's shitty and you should stop. You know, she said, quote, I don't know you. Do you enjoy writing these things? No one is happy about it. I think it's in bad taste and childish. So
yeah, I should just copy pasta that and paste it on so many threads. That
can you imagine being yelled at by the voice of Ash Ketchum? She's been the voice of him for...
yeah. You've done something wrong.
Yeah.
Although what you guys should post in the comments when you're listening to this is, I want to know, what are your weird, freaky, ancient Pokemon myths that you want to see crop up? You know, are we going weird, freaky, deaky Zeus Greek myth? Are we going kind of psychedelic Babylonian myth?
How
are we going to play it? Viking myths? Is there going to be some torn out Machop hearts, and I want to know.
Heaven or Hell expands on the Typhlosion thing, where allegedly Typhlosion committed James's face I'll say sexual assault against a girl until she agreed to marry him, and it threatened to hurt her family if she didn't cooperate. What is this, like Bluebeard but with Pokemon? Like,
I was gonna say, like, again, like, I could, I don't know why you'd turn Bluebeard into a Pokemon, but that was just a guy. If it was like Giovanni and he has like a room full of Meowth heads, or or what's the Persian heads? There's just a bunch of Persian heads on the wall. That's something, I guess.
I forgot that he mounted them on a wall.
Yeah.
Bluebeard's wild, man. Yeah. Also recently referenced in a movie I just watched, the live action thriller, The Cure, by a Kiyoshi Kiyotaka.
Oh, Cure?
Yeah.
That movie's incredible.
Yeah, I watched it for the first time, and I was just like, I think I like that movie more on vibes than necessarily the fact that it is entirely cohesive. Things get kind of wild and weird in it as far as, like, sometimes there's just shots of things, and I'm like, I don't know why.
The ending, though, with the waitress at the end there.
Yeah, that scene
lives in my head rent-free. I think about it on a regular basis.
And the main, like, antagonist is just, like, he's not really like any other antagonist I've seen in a film like that. Like,
have you seen Pulse?
Yes, I watched that one first. And then I was like, okay, I'll watch Cure. I really, really liked Pulse.
I feel like Pulse would be your, like, that's a Lindsay Kaur movie
there. That movie is amazing. Again, with the ending, I was like, I don't know that this needed to be a post-apocalyptic film at the end, but
at the end, that one, the ending of that movie is where it kind of loses me a bit, but also I like it. It's weird.
Yeah, it's very one of those weird.
Things where, like, I respect this. It's kind
not what
of
I would have done, maybe, but respect it. Yeah. But the entire scene with the slow motion walking lady is just,
that's one of the all-time greats. That's like an all-time great horror scene.
Yeah, love it. Love it. People in the chat, Onibaba might be weird as Pokemon. Onibaba lived in a cave and killed a pregnant woman to eat their baby. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see I want Pokemon Myth,
Qui-Don. That's what I want. I want like an anthology of Pokemon ghost stories.
Yeah. Something that like goes a little beyond. I mean, a lot of ghost Pokemon's Pokedex entries are kind of fucked up.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, you know, just do the whole Drifloon, a whole Drifloon story. I mean, that thing's
just
whole
Junji Ito it. Just like just literally.
Junji Ito is literally drawn art of the horror Pokemon. Do you remember that?
Like, yeah,
there's a legit Junji Ito Gengar.
We need this. Yes. What's the Junji Ito one with like the hanging balloons?
Yeah, right. Just make it a Drifloon instead. Yeah, just make it a Drifloon instead. Yeah. That about wraps it up. For news, you know, you guys keep sharing your Pokemon Wild theories in the chat. Mm-hmm. I didn't say this starting, but we were actually going to also talk about Silent Hill a little bit.
Oh my god.
James been playing Silent Hill too?
I've been playing Silent Hill too, and it has reignited my hyperfixation for Silent Hill.
Yeah.
I'm playing Silent Hill 1 on an emulator. I'm playing Silent Hill 2 on my PS5. It's gotten so bad, Lindsay. I am playing Silent Hill Homecoming on my Xbox.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're playing all these simultaneously?
Yeah, it's a sickness I have.
How are you gonna keep the plot threads from not like mixing
it's
up?
It's all vibes.
It's all just vibes. Yeah.
It's all vibes.
Yeah. I was watching AJ's stream. Their VTuber persona is Bolts the Mechanic. So that was kind of fun. Then I went to the wiki and I just like read everything all over again. I have beaten the original Silent Hill 2. It's just been, you know, like 20 years or something. Yeah. Fantastic game.
It's so scary.
It is so scary. It's so scary.
I just got out of the apartments and there were like several sequences where I was like, I don't know if I can do this right now. I don't know if I can go in that door because I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And they've changed up like several things in it. Mm-hmm. I noticed while I was watching AJ play that they would show like a scene like, okay, since you just got out of the apartment, right? Did you get to like the roof? Have you left the apartment complex?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And so there's like a scene, I think it's when you're on the roof of the apartment. It's like a broken barricade. Because in the original Silent Hill,
yeah.
The original Pyramid Head throws you off the roof.
Yes.
And so you see that, like it's there, but that's not what happens in the
I also noticed there's the coin puzzle, the three coins.
Yeah.
They expanded it. One thing I want to say is this game has noticeably good puzzles, like really fun, interesting, but not frustrating puzzles.
Yeah.
That I think they're better than the puzzles from the main game, at least the ones that I played so far.
They're longer. Like they are. Yeah.
And they require a little more thought and they use the environment in interesting ways. Like in the apartment, there's the cool one where you have to look at black light graffiti on the wall to decode the safe code. But I noticed that one of the floors of the apartment, the original coin puzzle box, like the simple three slot, it's like lying in the corner and you can like interact with it and like a weird little sound plays. So it's like,
oh, hey, interesting. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
I was theory crafting around the fact that the old stuff is there. I don't think this is just fan service cameo type stuff.
No, I think
there's something more going on with that. I watched AJ get to the other world version of the hospital. So I haven't seen anything past that.
Oh, I'm so excited for the hospital. That's my favorite part of the original game. That's like the scariest, just creepiest, grossest
place. It's nasty. Oh, it's just nasty. Yeah.
I saw Terrifier 3 this weekend.
Yeah.
And one of the reviews, it's either for 2 or 3 on Letterboxd that I saw, is like, you can just smell this movie. And Silent Hill 2 is a game that you can smell that game.
Yeah.
Every time James sticks his hand in like a horrible fetid toilet.
That's funny. The exact word I was thinking of was fetid, which was like, and there's a part also in the hospital where there's like this hole in the wall and it's got what looks like roaches all over it. And you got to put your hand in there and grab like some spray to like kill mold or whatever. And I'm just like, I know exactly what that smells like. That, like, nasty water smell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just, everything's wet all the time. And also James Sutherland is like, he's such a shit protagonist.
Like, but, you know, I gotta say, shout out though, the performances,
yeah,
the voice performances are so good. I was a little worried, I try not to be too precious about the original games because I think they're masterpieces, but they're also flawed. Like, they're not perfect. I think that's what makes them so appealing. But one of the things that I think is so iconic to those games, especially because none of them have gotten the modern remake treatment like the Resident Evil games have gotten, is they still have that late 90s, early 2000s stilted kind of weird voice acting. And in Silent Hill, I think it's more intentional. I think they're very much trying to go for like a David Lynch kind of dreamlike, surreal atmosphere. But it still sounds off compared to what you would expect in a game. And in this game, they're very much, they're much more naturalistic, much more realistic, much more emotive performances. And I was wondering, like, oh, is this going to take away from some of like that Silent Hill vibe? But I don't think that's the case at all. I think for where the story goes, which I obviously am not going to spoil, but you know, Lindsay. The places the story goes. I actually think it's going to make that hit even harder.
Because there's like a really uncomfortable emotional core to Silent Hill 2. Like, one of the things that makes the Silent Hill games great, and I've played, I haven't played the original, but I have played 2. I didn't beat 3, but I did play quite a bit of 3. 4 is The Room, and I played that one. And which one comes immediately after that?
So after that, we have Origins on the PSP. There's Homecoming on the Xbox.
Okay, I played Homecoming, but I didn't play Origins. And I didn't play Downpour. So Homecoming was actually like the last one that I played. And
it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, as far as what I remember from it, because I played all these around like release, so it's been a long time. But all of them are willing to engage in trauma in really uncomfortable ways with its characters. I guess, like, for folks who don't know that, if this was going to be your first Silent Hill, content warnings all over the place, especially 2, which has a lot of really overt sexual themes just in the, even in the monster design and stuff like that. There's literally a monster whose name is the Beast with Two Backs. Yeah, it's not subtle. None of it's subtle.
Yeah, I would say that's the thing. I think, and I've seen some people comment on this, especially if the horror games you're used to playing are like Dead Space, Resident Evil.
Stuff where like zombies jump out at you and you just shoot them sort of deal,
Silent Hill is incredible. I wouldn't call it traditionally fun because it is such an overwhelming, oppressive, dark, stressful experience. Like, it does not want you to feel good.
Yeah,
it's very good at that. Like, even the sound design, Akira Yamaoka's score and sound design, that's half the reason why there are times where I'm like, I can't play more than like an hour of this without getting stressed.
Yeah,
but I can like blast through a whole Resident Evil, like that's fine because that's like campy horror. But Silent Hill 2 is like sad and miserable and very overtly like just oppressive.
Oh, yeah, for real. So watching AJ play did make me want to buy it and play it again. I would probably put the combat on, like, super easy because they don't give you a lot of healing items either.
It gets better. It has the same thing that the original game had where it weirdly, like, once you get past the hotel, even in the part that I just have been playing, they start, like, dumping items on you to where, like, you will have... If you're, like, exploring every nook and cranny, you'll be fine. But the early parts of the game can be a little, like, touch and go.
So, I don't know, maybe I'll throw that on after I finish every other game that I need to finish, but it,
just do what I do and play 7 games at the same time and take...
Oh, man. All right, James, let's get into some anime.
Yeah.
Should we start with...
Some Danime?
Some Danime, yeah. Let's start with Dandadan. We touched on this last week when we talked about the first episode, but... Again, quick plot recap for Dandadan. You've got Okarun, who believes in aliens but does not believe in ghosts. And you've got Momo, who believes in ghosts but does not believe in aliens. By the end of episode 1, they believe in both because now Okarun is cursed and has had his... Now, I said earlier, like last time, that it's his balls. But actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I think originally it is his... penis, and then later that changes.
His ham and eggs are gone.
Yes, yeah. Later that will change. Momo's not cursed, but she has awakened her psychic powers, which is she is needing to use in order to keep Okarun from being overtaken by Turbo Granny, which is the cursed ghost entity that has stolen his genitals. So
she's on the verge of having a hemorrhage at like every possible moment. So that's her.
Momo is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
she's bleeding from draining. The face.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really liked episode two. When I got to see the first three episodes, this one was actually my favorite. Ooh. I think, because it just does some really interesting stuff visually that, again, shows why it's worth watching the anime, even if you've read the manga, because it's a new experience having it in color, having it in motion. And Saint Seiya didn't even have to go this hard, but they're going like so hard on this show. So
they're putting the stank on it.
Yes. Yeah. So what we're looking at here, they finally have made it back to the temple where Momo lives with her grandma. Okarun cannot pass through the Torii gate because he's cursed. So Momo has to remove a ward that's on the gate so he can pass through it, but she forgets to put it back and that causes some problems. What this episode does really well and what I really like about it is that this is the episode where I feel like we get the best representation of their relationship.
Yeah.
Of how there's both like that friendly animosity between the two where like neither of them is shy to make fun of the other one.
Yes, 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 yes.
But it's like unique, I feel, compared to other anime, because usually the way Okarun will openly mock Momo is not something I feel like we actually see that often between like male-female characters in that way.
No, it nails that like romantic comedy trick that it's hard to do, where the characters being kind of aggressive and even mean to each other.
Yeah.
It is likable because it's showing how comfortable they are with each other.
Yeah.
It's so easy to cross that line to where they're just like sniping at each other and it's not fun. But for these two, you can tell that, and for Okarun especially, he's never talked to anyone like this before.
Yeah.
But he instantly feels like he can just say whatever's on his mind to her. And that to me is what makes their relationship so likable. I read that quote where the author talked about where he was ordered to read 100 shoujo manga.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he says that in an interview
before they take his pitch.
Yeah. Yeah, his editor is really, really good. Same editor that I believe is on Spy Family and quite a few other big series for Shonen Jump. I'm glad that they had him do that. Because I mean he'd been working under Tatsuki Fujimoto before this. Mm-hmm. Was it romance manga or like specifically shoujo manga?
I want to say the quote said shoujo, but it might have been romance. Mm-hmm. But the end point being, like, this needs a little something else. And specifically, we need to get you outside of the traditional genre constraints that you're trying to fit this story into.
Yeah.
So you're going to read something that might seem like it's completely outside of the wheelhouse. But obviously, I think that Momo and Okarun's relationship is what makes Dandadan so special.
Yes. Yeah, I agree completely. Their chemistry and just the way that they bounce off each other is one of the major highlights of the show, beyond even just the amazing animation or the supernatural elements as well. When I interviewed the director, he talked about how important it is that Momo and Okarun are paired protagonists. I think I said this last week too, but like this isn't like the Okarun show and Momo's just there as the sidekick to end up falling for him or whatever. They're supposed to be co-protagonists. And it's really refreshing because like we see stuff like My Hero Academia, which is great in other ways, but one of the main criticisms of that has always been that the female characters aren't utilized as much, that you know Uravity doesn't get as much time to shine as Deku. So it kind of feels like that only if they were completely like one-to-one.
Yes. I have something to add to that too when we get to later in the episode, but the screenshot you had up there, I didn't just clip that because it's funny that he farted on her, even though it is. But I kind of to the point we're just talking about, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got about romance was from my 10th grade English teacher, Mr. LeClaire. So if you're listening, Mr. LeClaire, which you're not, but if you are, thank you, sir. But the advice that he gave me was you shouldn't ever feel ready to marry someone until you've farted around them frequently and they farted around you.
I've heard this advice before. I think
It's good advice because again, if you don't feel comfortable letting one rip around your spouse, then the next 70 plus years of your life are going to be pretty rough. And the fact that they're using that crude humor to really cement, like, these two are, they're meant for each other. Like, they are just two peas in a pod. She is obviously more comfortable with him than she was with that last asshole that she was
dating. Yeah, for real.
And she's the first friend he's ever had. And
yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, it's great. And I mean, this might sound silly, but like, something about that particular interaction too also just felt more genuine and real, as far as like a dumb argument teenagers would have about like farting in front of someone while you're literally in front of them.
Well, again, and when you're close to someone, that's the kind of stuff that comes up. Like, you know, when you're bonding, that, you know, it's not all fighting aliens, right?
Yeah. But the alien fight was also really good.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So this is like a sumo themed, it's an Flatwoods alien
monster,
but yeah, it looks like the Flatwoods monster. That's what the whole, sort of around its head kind of look is. And the fight is really interesting. It's another opportunity for Momo to really show off, but we get the cool transformation from Okoroon in this one.
Such a great design.
It is. And if you go read the interview again, this is the one where the director went way off script with me to talk to me about Ultraman, because this entire bit was Ultraman reference as far as the colors, but it really makes the red pop. So that looked really cool. I'm also just a fan of cryptids and stuff in general. So I love the Flatwood.
And I like that reference. The story, it's done its homework. I listened to the last podcast on the left, and my favorite episodes of that show are all the alien episodes and the ghost episodes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I loved here is they talk about how one of the big prevailing theories about like paranormal phenomenon and UFO phenomenon is the idea that, like, some people think of aliens as just literal beings in spaceships from another planet, but there are a lot of people that look at aliens as psychic, you know, spiritual manifestations. It's just like another side of the ghost coin, right? Or the spirit world coin. And so the fact that they work that into the lore, where I thought, why would an alien be using the ghost doorbell that your grandma, and then it's like, oh, well, technically, if it's all coming from this weird woo-wee-woo psychic alternate universe, wherever these things are from, they sense it's all part of the same stew.
I liked how they eventually solved the conundrum by Momo just getting bodied.
And it was Momo that got to do that. And most manga, that would totally be Okoroon.
Yeah.
Is the one that get, you know, they both get their kind of figure it out moments.
Yes.
Okoroon gets his big transformation and he gets to do some real damage. But then Momo's the one that gets to actually figure out the Tori Gate thing. And
Yeah.
Like you said, it's equal. It's very balanced.
Yes. Yeah. So I really enjoyed that as well. And then I think the scene that got clipped the most as far as like on social media and stuff was his transformation scene. That scene is wild because he looks at his hand and then his hand gets all gnarly and then it breaks out and then he turns into this
cut. I say it's a sick cut. It has nothing to do with, but when he drops his glasses and you see her her refracted reflection in his glasses and it's like this hand-drawn effect.
Yeah.
Like, that probably took someone a month to do. And it's like a 2-second shot, but it makes this whole scene even creepier and like more insane.
Yeah, very cool. So excited to see next episode. For those of you who didn't see it in theaters, I'll just tell you that it also looks amazing. So episode 3 will be good. That'll be out on Thursday.
I'm hoping we do not hit. I don't think Science Star is gonna hit the 3-episode curse or anything. I feel like they've got their production under control usually.
I think so. I mean, I saw those first 3 episodes back in July. So that's like how much headway they had already made. Episodes were complete by that point. So,
I mean, Chainsaw Man had a similar situation, right? Where like they had like some ridiculous amount of lead time to like maintain that level of quality, where this was done like a year ago, basically.
Yeah.
Which is what you need to, you know, not kill your animators.
Yes. Speaking of not killing people, so an orb. I'm glad nothing bad happens to our boy Rafal here,
who is our wonderful main character, protagonist of the story,
who's just doing his best to bring the truth to the people. No, so I had read the manga, so I knew this was coming, but I had forgot. because it was a while ago. So, but once it happened, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this weirded me out when I read it. Completely forgot. So where we last left Rafal is that he was taking over for Hubert, who had committed a second act of heresy and gotten caught. So he was out of the picture, and he had told Rafal to like burn all of his notes and everything. And Rafal did initially, but then saved them because he was like, now that I know about heliocentrism, I can't forget about it.
He's been truth-pilled.
He's been truth-pilled.
He went science woke. We can't even have geocentrism anymore because of woke.
Because of woke. Yes, that is basically what happens in this screenshot I just had up. He is wearing a necklace that belonged to Hubert that kind of was supposed to represent that concept. He's immediately stopped by Novak, who is our inquisitor, and he's like, hey, so why you got that? And I'm like, this kid is so dumb wearing this out in public. This kid is so stupid, so smart and so stupid. He's like, it's a reminder to, you know, never forget what happened, but also I don't know anything about his research, and also no, of course not, I'm going to study theology and all these sorts of things.
I would never do a heresy when I'm studying in my room every night. Why would you ask?
Which is why his adoptive father finds out, because he doesn't make sure all of his paper, which is probably like a weird paper that includes animal fat or something in it and doesn't burn as well as it should.
Full of grease.
So his adoptive father finds it and figures out that he is studying heliocentrism. And that's when we find out that his father was also at one point studying heliocentrism, which we probably should have suspected because he was friends with Hubert.
And he had all those books.
He was like,
why does my dad have all these books on this subject that he hates and wants me to refute? That's weird.
That's weird. And had gotten caught once. So if his father is caught again, he'll be burned at the stake. And that is why Novak corners him to get him to turn in his adoptive son.
I do love that his dad is like a truth junkie that relapsed when he found that note. Like, he just couldn't help but like scribble some revisions to his equations when he found the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know what you're talking about, son. I just, you gotta watch out. That paper doesn't burn very good. He's like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Once you get that first hit of heliocentrism, you can't go back.
Got to put it right there in the veins.
Just for it for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. So Rafal gets brought into prison, and they're like, if you repent immediately, you can still go to college. We won't have to torture you. It'll go on your record, and just don't be thinking about the sun so much anymore after this, and you'll be fine. And that's where things took a turn, right? Mm-hmm. That we didn't expect, which is that Rafal, a child after my own heart, was like, no, fuck you. I'm not.
We and orbit also, the sun, bitches.
We orbit the sun. And also, I mean, there was some foreshadowing that he had gone out and he had decided to do this before he ever showed up in court, because he had gone out and bought a bunch of poppy seeds and poisoned himself. And he was like, no, we orbit the sun, and also fuck you and your rules. I'm out. And you don't get to torture me because I'm leaving on my own terms. Bye. How old is he supposed to be?
Like what? 12? Something like that. Like, I don't even know how old he's a teenager yet.
How old do you go to college in the 15th century?
Whenever you're smart enough to do it, was the way, like, schooling was just like, yeah, you can do the work, then you do the work, and then, like, with Shakespeare, it talks about how he had like no education. He had like a tutor, but like, they basically just taught you until you could do stuff, and then they sent you on your way. And they had universities, but it was nowhere near as
right.
It wasn't like now where a university is like a thing that not everyone, but a lot of people do.
Yeah.
You had to be real rich and real special to go to a
university. Real rich, or you were like, you had a patron or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andrew McGee says, I know folks would go to Oxford as early as 14 in the 14th, 16th century. Yeah. I mean, I would put him on like the cusp of puberty. He's not tall yet. Right.
Well, and at that time, like 14, 15, that was considered like adulthood at that point.
Yeah.
Like, there was no, you know, the concept of like your teenage years. That wasn't a thing. you were a kid until you were old enough to get married and or do a job, and then you were basically an adult. And so the fact,
and they do refer to him as a child continuously in this, and people have said there's a lot of historical, not revisionism, but you know, they're taking liberties with things,
telling me the country of P is not a real country.
The it's not, because it's the kingdom of P.
The kingdom of P, yeah,
the kingdom of P. So anyway, I thought that was a baller move on his part.
And on the anime's part, killing your ostensible protagonist, and this is going for a full 6 months, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and now granted, it's not like it's a 12 episode show and we just spent a quarter of the anime with a character who's now dead.
Yeah.
But still, like, the fact that the show had set him up like as our main character and as the person whose like journey we were going to follow, and it's really reinforcing that in this version of history, if you're a 12-year-old that's preaching the heathen ideology of heliocentrism, they will murder you, or you'll have to murder yourself in an act of defiance. And, and we get like, what, a 10-year time jump at the end of
that? Yeah.
So the scope of this story is a lot bigger than I was originally anticipating. And that actually makes me really excited. I'm more excited for the show now that he's dead, unfortunately. Like, that sounds mean. I'm not glad that he died, but I'm like, oh, this story has like plans.
Yeah, I mean, he is featured heavily in the opening sequence, to the point where if we didn't know for a fact that after he killed himself, they still burned him, I would think that somehow he's going to come back.
I don't know. It's an anime. Maybe he'll show up as like a science ghost.
He could be a science ghost. He could be featured heavily because they're like, oh, well, you know, he carries on through the actions of other characters that are going to show up because he continued the truth of heliocentrism. Because we see that he has left behind his own note and stuff in a similar container, I guess you could say, that Hubert did.
Yeah.
And then we see briefly, I think, a new character at the end of this, right?
Dark-haired guy. They find the notes. And I mean, and it totally plays into the conversation that Nowak was having with Raffles' dad, where he's talking about how when you're burned at the stake, not only is your body burned and not only is the pain horrible, but the leading academics believe that you don't get to go to heaven because the part of you that's your soul also gets burned up, right? You deny yourself your eternal life. There's nothing.
Right. I think what he's talking about is the concept of the resurrection. So it's the idea that once the world ends and Jesus comes back, everyone's resurrected from the grave, but you don't have a body. You don't have a physical body.
That's why they used to not let you do autopsies and stuff.
Oh, yeah. And cremation.
But then Raffles like talks about how basically like the truth can't die. And if I practice the truth, if I spread the truth like an epidemic, he calls it, then it doesn't matter what happens to me because the truth is still going to live on. And that's his resurrection, is his ideas, which I thought was really cool thematically.
Pui Pui Mul says, weird that they're going by ancient Egypt rules. I didn't know that the Egyptians had, I mean, I know that they didn't cremate people typically, but
I don't know how much of it was like related to resurrection, but like the whole idea that like, you needed to put all the stuff with them because they needed to bring all their stuff in the afterlife or to have all their things. So there's definitely that, like, your body wasn't done even when you died. Like, things were still happening with it.
Yeah.
Man, science has come a long way.
Yeah. Yeah, it has.
Which isn't to say that, you know, if you believe in the afterlife, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, you know, the fact that we're not, like, denying scientific progress hundreds of years of opportunities. We're not
burning 12-year-olds' corpses at the stake.
Also that.
What
is this, Made in Abyss?
Are we still freezing heads? I don't know what that means. What?
Like the Walt Disney myth, like the, you know, freeze your head to try to bring you back in like 1,000 years,
I know that is like a Simpson bit. Is that related to the Simpson bit on why there's a whole bunch of like heads in, or maybe that's Futurama? Sorry, the Futurama.
Well, I think I've read that there are like really rich people who have basically like rented out like a cryo service to just keep their bodies cryoed up for however long they can, just in case, you know,
in case
you come up with something. I don't know.
I don't, if they come up, I don't want to come back.
No, I mean,
you want to come back.
Guys, every time you come back in a horror movie, you're a demon.
Yeah.
We know this.
Yeah.
You let something in. It's like, talk to me. You know, let something in.
That was a good movie. Did you see that one?
Yes. I liked it. I have issues with it, but I think the party scene is one of the coolest and most original horror scenes I've seen in years.
Yeah.
And so for that alone, I think the movie's worth watching. I didn't like the ending, but
care for it. Yeah. Yeah. Cryo stuff is a big scam. LOL are, as it's cryoed, all the cell walls are wrecked. It might bring you back. You'll just turn into slime.
I mean, maybe they'll like get to, I was going to say, maybe they'll upload your brain into like a computer.
I don't want to do that.
No,
everyone, I just need you to know, I need to be on the record that when I die, I'm staying dead. If you bring me back, I'm going to be really mad. Okay. Like I already did it. I did all the things and now I want to biodegrade and return to the earth. It's very important to me.
Have you played Soma, the horror game Soma?
I haven't. I think I've played some of it.
That game freaks me out so much because the whole concept of like, if you upload your brain into the computer, you're just making a copy of yourself.
Right.
Your regular brain is still going to be, you know.
Yeah.
Like if you copy your brain, are you copying your soul or are you just making a clone?
Oh, okay. So,
or like with teleportation, like, are you just do you die when you go into a teleporter and then a perfect clone of you just walks out and lives the rest of your life?
I've never thought of that.
For some reason, like that whole,
like concept, if we're talking about like copying you on a like a cellular level,
yeah,
you know, and then
but does your consciousness go, or is it just someone that has your exact brain and memories and thinks that they are you, but the minute you walked into that teleporter, black forever, and now there's just someone else walking out around there thinking that they came out of the teleporter just fine, but we'll never know. There's literally no way to know.
The movie about this is great.
That's a part that's great. Kind of sort of what Soma gets into.
Okay.
And it is existentially horrifying.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, Orb really shaping up, I think, to be our like dark horse anime to talk about for the rest of the season.
It's got big ideas.
Yeah. It's got full of good ideas, doing some good stuff. Madhouse is carrying it well enough, like looks pretty dang good most of the time. I think amazing, but
this third episode I thought was a little weaker. It just didn't have like some of the depth or some of the cinematic feel that like the first episode had, but there's nothing like wonky. There's nothing that stood out.
I think the best scene was his last discussion with Novak, where he starts like quoting the philosophers and stuff, and like, as our chat said, he basically goes, the truth will spread and it will live and I will die.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of conviction can be really stirring.
Yeah, no, yeah. I was like, God, I wish I was as cool as this kid. you know?
Yeah. I just need that opportunity to make one really good speech. Someone just give me the opportunity to make that one good speech full of conviction.
You say that and you're gonna be at some like sports event or something for like one of your kids or some family member, and they're gonna be like, all right, this is your time, like we need this, we're down 45 points, and if you don't rally us, we're gonna lose the game, we're gonna be crushed, we're not gonna get to go on our big trip, you know, little Rudy over there is gonna die from boninitis, and it's it's like, oh, okay.
And I'm like, what sport is this again?
Is this the one with the touchdowns?
Is this the touchdown or the home run? Do we need a three-pointer? Like, I can't, yeah.
Can dogs play? Is Air Bud allowed?
Is it? Yeah, anyone got a golden retriever? Can I defer
to Air Bud?
Oh, man.
Are there any rules that say a dog can't play? Because that's the key.
What about multiple dogs? Maybe this could be the Air Buddies.
Yes.
Version, which my kid definitely watched. Or
let's mix it up. Let's bring in the Homeward Bound animals.
There we go. Original or a remake? Because because Spike's a different dog depending on which version you watch. Yeah.
I've never seen the original. I just remember getting really upset whenever I saw it in movie stores because I was like, oh, wait a minute, it's not right. It was like a doppelganger effect. I was like, who'd watch this?
I've seen the original because, you know, if it was raining way too hard outside, elementary school would bring in the TV into the school gym, and we were just all supposed to, like, stay there, and definitely had OG Homeward Bound at least once.
That makes sense.
All right, ending comment, I guess, is I did actually watch the first two episodes of the Ron Nolan Half remake, and they're pretty okay.
Yeah, I liked them. I thought they were very fun.
Yeah.
Did the OP do it for you?
It's a good OP, but it's just not the OP, you know? You know, but that's just how it be. That's just how it's got to be. All right, James. Well, I think that about wraps us up for this week. We'll be back next Tuesday at 6:15 to discuss whatever's happening in the anime news, and as well as Don to Don and Orb. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Watch out for Typhlosions, I guess.
The AN and After Show is an official podcast of Anime News Network. You can hang out with us live on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube and Twitter. Listen to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. The AN and After Show is hosted by Lindsay Loveridge and James Beckett and is produced by Lindsay Loveridge.